This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The moment of shock is just unforgettable.
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby, available now.
New Orleans, a party town if ever there was one. And yet a place of unimaginable horror.
And with much of New Orleans now underwater, authorities are focused on search and rescue before it's too late.
The Big Easy, home of Mardi Gras, and now an 11th Super Bowl. The site of terror and pain, man-made and natural. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Katie Smith with this bonus episode of the podcast I host, Sports Hour. Now, if you're not a sports fan, don't be put off by the title. Over the next hour, we'll transcend sport. It has warmth, it has heartache, and it has joy. This is NOLA, the birthplace of jazz. And funeral marches. We'll take you around this city that's had to endure seismic tragedy that threatened its entire existence and hear from those who nearly lost everything.
It's still just so fresh, and I can't really understand why. It's been 20 years.
And those who stayed to rebuild it.
It was a very emotional time for both of us. Should we go or should we stay? I said, you know, I just don't know if we're going to be able to rebuild the dome. I don't know if the city's going to be able to come back. I mean, we had these moments where we were really shaken to the core and did some soul searching.
On Sunday, back-to-back Super Bowl champions Kansas City are aiming for an historic three-peat.
Can Mahomes do it? Clinch it!
They're about to head to New Orleans.
Trying to stop them and lift the Lombardi Trophy for just the second time, it's the Philadelphia Eagles.
Touchdown! Fly, Eagles, fly to Super Bowl 59!
So who will win Super Bowl 59? Welcome to the big game in the Big Easy. I'm Katie Smith, and welcome to Sports Hour at the Super Bowl New Orleans edition. And on Sunday, every seat here at the Superdome will be taken. It'll be standing room only. The tension will be unbearable, and it will test people's patience, resilience, and optimism. But thankfully, the only thing on the line will be the game. 20 years ago, it was literally a matter of life or death.
Hurricane Katrina, about 30 miles southeast of New Orleans, the next 60 to 90 minutes critical for that city.
New Orleans, known as the party capital of the South, synonymous with warm welcomes, Mardi Gras, and all that jazz. But in August 2005, it changed forever. Now when people think of New Orleans, they think Hurricane Katrina.
You need to be scared, and you need to get your butts moving out of New Orleans. This is the storm of the century.
It was here, in the Superdome, where I'm standing right now, which became the city's shelter of last resort. If you didn't have the means of escaping or had nowhere to go, you could find protection here at the Superdome.
Still several hundred people lined up trying to get inside the Superdome. We were told by some people waiting in line they'd been sitting there for over 4 hours trying to get inside.
What happened next at the Superdome marked the start of the misery, suffering and devastation that whirled in alongside the hurricane.
Thousands of people filled the stands, mostly the poor, the handicapped and the elderly. But then the levees broke and all of those people were trapped. There was no electricity, little food and little water.
And what happened here just a year later became the symbol of the city's resolution, the recovery and the rebirth.
A moment. almost unimaginable 13 months ago is here. The NFL, the Saints, back in New Orleans, back in the Super Bowl.
And at the very heart of it would be Doug and Denise Thornton.
It was a blind date. We met at Ruby Tuesdays.
Doug was and still is the manager of the Superdome. He and his wife Denise made their life in New Orleans in the 1990s.
How long have we been married?
1984 is when we met. We got married in 88.
I thought we met in 83.
It's through their eyes we'll learn what it was like to be inside the Superdome when Katrina hit.
As we enter the Superdome's dark, forbidding corridors, it's easy to see how families were separated. The field itself looks like a battlefield, a sharp contrast.
It's Saturday, 27th of August, 2005. And while the roads out of New Orleans are jam-packed with people fleeing, the Thorntons are making their way into the city.
We drove back in that Saturday, realizing that this was going to be a very bad storm. A great sense of anticipation, not knowing what the next few days were going to bring. And I was on the phone. They wanted to open the Superdome the next morning as a refuge of last resort.
I felt like I could help, and what else was I going to do? I mean, I felt compelled to be there to help.
They secured their house and belongings as best as they could and headed to the Superdome to prepare for Sunday to welcome 850 patients too ill to be evacuated.
National Guard was very instrumental. I was down at the South Gate getting people in. There was a MASH unit kind of set up.
I think it was 6 a.m. Sunday morning. They announced that the dome would be open as a refuge of last resort. By 10 a.m., 2 hours before we opened, the line to get in here was over a quarter mile long. And I think it was a bit of a surprise to all of us just how many people showed up on that first day.
There were just 18 members of staff and 375 members of the National Guard. Numbers began to swell. 10,000 became 20. Eventually 30,000 people would be huddled in the Superdome. The storm arrived in the early hours of Monday morning. The winds ripped massive holes in the roof of the Superdome, and debris began to fall. It was endangering people that were sheltering on the field below. They had to be moved into the stands. After several hours, the wind began to die down. The sun came out. It seemed like the ordeal was over.
We did not know at the time that the levees had breached. So the next morning, we got up. I'm walking down the hall to meet Colonel Mouton. He said, "Have you seen the water on Poydras Street? There's 5 feet of water on Poydras Street." I said, "Oh my God." And I look out and I see probably 2.5 to 3 feet of water piled up against the door. And I look down and I see the water seeping underneath the door.
They were cut off from the chaos swirling outside, but the chaos was building inside the dome. Whilst the main generator continued to work, there was no running water and only dim emergency lighting. It was beginning to resemble a dystopian movie.
And I was afraid that if we went totally dark in here, that there would be a great loss of light. People would just panic and they would trample each other trying to get out.
So people were also swimming in.
They were coming in at the time. They were walking in, you know, water up to neck high, lifting their belongings above their head to get here because this was the only place that was elevated.
And I think a lot of people felt trapped. They were chanting and wanting to get out, and for their own safety, they couldn't leave. The alarm was going off and you couldn't get the alarm off. So it was this winding alarm noise constantly with the lights flashing because that somehow jammed and they couldn't get it to stop.
So it just stuff that you could never imagine was happening, okay? And it was all happening in real time.
Tuesday turned to Wednesday. Food was running short, as was patience inside what must have felt like a Superdome prison. One man died by suicide, one from a drug overdose. There were reports of sexual violence towards young women.
The simplest of tasks were becoming so difficult. So the way we had to feed people every day, 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. in the afternoon, and we had our National Guard distributing those commodities. Now, they started lining up at 4 a.m. because they were afraid they weren't going to get any food. And then we had the bad guys, people that are always trying to prey on the weak. I would say 98% of the people in here were just God-fearing, lovely people just trying to survive. And then there were those that wanted to disrupt. What really made it difficult, no running water means no functioning toilets, okay, after a day or two. The commodities were beginning to get scarce, no medical supplies.
For me, it was a lot scarier, I guess, maybe because I'm a woman. Maybe Doug thinks 98% of the population was help, but I didn't see it that way. I didn't feel safe. We were hearing about all the horrible things that were going on. There were, I don't want to say, but other things happened that we were hearing about, and we were I was afraid that maybe we wouldn't get out.
Put yourself in their shoes, the people that were here, the evacuees, even us. We were feeling the same way about, when are we going to get out? What's going on out in the outside world? And are we going to be able to go home at some point? And what's happening with our homes? It was, you know, it became a sense of desperation.
Wednesday became Thursday. There was no sign of relief.
It was literally like a war zone. Helicopters were in and out all day long, all night long.
I spent a lot of time outside just watching the helicopters come and go. And I spent a lot of time out just watching. It was just a very scary time. I didn't know what had happened to our home, to my family. My family couldn't reach me, and I knew that my sister was beside herself. You know, I just prayed a lot that we would all be safe, but it made me evaluate my own life. And if I didn't make it out safely, what had my life meant? What had I done to make a difference in the world? And I came up short. So I just made a promise to God that if I got out, that I would try to do what I could to help other people and to mend our broken city.
Eventually, after more than 5 days without running water, with damp and dingy lighting, people were finally allowed to leave, only to find their city, everything they had, left in ruins. Now the question became, what next? Should they leave New Orleans for good? And how do you rebuild a city torn to pieces? Well, Doug and Denise knew they had to stay, to try. But they were utterly divided on where to start that overwhelming task. We'll be back with the couple a little later.
I'm honored to be here tonight, and I want to thank the NFL for inviting me to welcome you to the weekend's Stanley Superdome, home of the New Orleans Saints.
I'm still stood in the Superdome. It's majestic, with its cavernous arching dome, the sense of anticipation in the air, and the noise as well. I bet you're wondering about that. Well, before the Super Bowl, it also plays host to opening night. And if you're like me, and you've never been to the big game before, you might not know what opening night is. So let me be your guide to what I can assure you is a unique event in the landscape of sports media. Let me paint a picture for you then. I am standing here on the field of play. Thousands of fans have paid to be here and watch. And there's thousands of journalists here as well, all of whom are waiting to gain access to every member of the Kansas and Philly teams. So I've been getting some tips from reporter Faith Pinnow on what to expect.
You're going to weasel your way to the front. You're small.
There's a lot of people who are going to be trying to get in my way, right?
Yeah, like a lot of people. And they've been here for hours, and they're hungry. You just got to kind of like squeeze your way in, make direct eye contact with him, like lock eyes, and then just yell his name as loudly as you can. And until you think he's looking at you, then ask your question. You might have to ask it a lot of times, but he'll hear you. You can do it.
And then there's the fans.
Guys, it is such a delight to talk to you. We're going to have to shout because okay. It's really, really loud on opening night. It's fantastic.
And it's absolutely amazing. I don't live here. She does. I came in to volunteer for the host city committee, and it's day one for me here in New Orleans, and it is amazing.
Right. So what is so good about opening night then?
You have fans from all over, all different teams. You
guys from UK are here. You have people from Mexico. You have people from other international. It's all about coming together, having a good time, and loving the love of football.
Have a great evening, ladies.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Right, the teams are out now. A countdown clock is on the stadium scoreboard. I've sharpened my elbows. Wish me luck, everyone, as I try to get a few moments with a player.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's a blessing to be here.
This is Jeremiah Trotter Jr. And just for context, the chap who interviewed him before me, well, he only had one question. And that was, which of your teammates breaks wind the most?
No, it's definitely different, you know, during the regular season and other playoff games. You know, we just come to work and, you know, get going. But it's something that you just got to, you know, make sure we stay focused on. You know, we go to the media, love talking to you guys, love sharing, you know, answering questions. But, you know, when it's over with, we got to lock back in on the main goal.
I just cannot imagine another sport allowing the stars of its biggest game to be subjected to a press free-for-all just days out from the big one. But I am kind of pleased they do. Before we leave the Superdome for the streets of the French Quarter, let's go back to Denise and Doug Thornton. He's the man in charge of the Superdome both now and in 2005 during Hurricane Katrina. After they escaped the horrors of the stadium, they were left divided. Denise wanted to rebuild homes and communities in New Orleans. Doug, he was fixated on bringing the Superdome back to life.
The notion that if for some reason the Superdome couldn't be rebuilt, it would sort of cause this whole psychological effect on the city, because it was the one thing that people saw around the world that they associated Katrina with. Okay. It was the poster child for suffering and misery. And if it were simply to be torn down and not be rebuilt, then it would almost be like New Orleans has given up.
That was a bone of contention between the two of us for quite a while. I felt like he was wasting money on a building when people didn't have a place to live. He's building the Superdome back for fans that don't have a home. I was tough between the two of us for a while. And we just decided to, you've got your view, I've got mine. We'll just go our separate ways and do what we do. And hopefully the two will join at some point.
For me, it was about the symbolism of rebuilding the Superdome, because if we couldn't do that, it was going to create this psychological fog over the city and stymie the rebuilding effort, I think, for many, many years.
He was right. The Superdome was an iconic building that needed to come back. But at the time, I was more interested in getting my community back before spending all this millions of dollars on renovating a building, one building, when people didn't have food to eat or a home to live in. They were living in tents. They were living in FEMA trailers. Why couldn't that money be spent getting people back and then rebuild the building for people to have a place to watch a football game?
There was this really critical moment in time when Denise and I, like everybody else in New Orleans, I know everybody had the same sort of heartfelt moment where they were thinking, should I go or should I stay and rebuild? And thank goodness we had more people say they were going to stay and rebuild. And because of Denise's efforts, eventually over the next 5 years, she was able to bring people back. Those people that were on the fence, she was able to bring them back. And for me, we were able to rebuild the Superdome, which was a catalyst to creating that confidence level in the community. I'm so glad we stayed.
Denise set up the Beacon of Hope Foundation. She helped thousands of people rebuild their lives in the communities that had been destroyed.
Oh, I think absolutely it changed me. I was the kind of person who just wrote the check before. After I did what I did in the neighborhood, and the joy I got from helping people changed me for the better. It's still just, it's just so fresh. And I can't really understand why. It's been 20 years.
For Doug, the threat of the New Orleans Saints football team being permanently relocated to Texas had made him even more determined to have the Superdome ready to host NFL matches again. And remarkably, after missing just one season, the Superdome once again opened its doors to the public as the Saints took on the Atlanta Falcons.
That night was a magical night. I remember standing outside watching people come in, you know, grown men and women with tears in their eyes, because They didn't think they'd ever be back in here again. It was such a symbol of resilience that night. I felt so proud. I just remember one moment for me, it was a particularly poignant moment. We were standing on the sidelines during the pregame show when U2 and Green Day took the field, and the house lights went dark. You know, I put the spotlight on the field, and there was this eerie feeling that came over me. It was very much that light level was very much like it was during Katrina. And I got these chills down my spine, and I turned and did not watch the show, but I turned to face the crowd, and I found myself standing at about the same location where I found the lightning rod on the morning that the roof was failing. And I look up into the seating section, into the same seating section where I saw these people huddled from the wind and rain. Now they're cheering, and I see happy faces, and I just burst into tears.
But for Denise, going back to the Superdome was not a cause for celebration.
Every time I went back into that building, I would have panic attacks. Every time I would see a helicopter, the sound of a helicopter would give me panic attacks. And, you know, I finally got around that.
That first game back didn't disappoint. So famous was Saint Steve Gleason heroically blocking a Falcons punt attempt that resulted in the first touchdown of the night. I can see the statue that was built to commemorate that moment. The fans' return had justified everything Doug and Denise had put themselves through for the city of New Orleans.
And I realized right then, you know, I said, you know what? This building had kind of taken on the human characteristics. It was on life support. It was left for dead. And then we brought it back to life. And I realized that it was the people in those seats that had come back that were bringing it back to life. The building is just steel and concrete, but it's the people of New Orleans who give it the life. And boy, that was an emotional moment for me and everyone around me that had been involved in that. There was not a dry eye in the house that night. I think if you ask anybody who was at that game, they will tell you that's probably aside from maybe the birth of their children, it's probably the biggest moment in their lifetime.
It's here we leave the Superdome, then, that the stories from the Crescent City keep on coming. And when we come back, we'll be in the French Quarter, talking jazz and football. Thanks for listening, and if you'd like to hear more stories, just search Sports Hour wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.
From the BBC World Service, this is The Documentary. I'm Katie Smith in New Orleans for the 2025 Super Bowl. Welcome to Bourbon Street, in the heart of the French Quarter in New Orleans. Last month, it was the scene of a heartbreaking attack that left 14 people dead. It's one of the reasons there's an overwhelming law enforcement presence here in New Orleans. It hasn't, though, put people off from partying and playing a bit of jazz. But then this is the city of contrast. When poet Philip Larkin wrote about his love of New Orleans jazz, he said, "My Crescent City is where your speech alone is understood and greeted as the natural noise of good, scattered long-haired grief and scored pity." It's a reminder that even for those who have lived here forever, it's a city that holds joy and sorrow, temptation and tribulation, even if you've played in multiple Super Bowls. 50 years ago, Jackie Wallace stepped out to play in Super Bowl IX, here in his hometown of New Orleans.
Now the crowd of 80,000 settles back down again. Great play by Jackie Wallace.
But it was how he made the news some 20 or so years later that for some is how he's better remembered. Jackie had gone from NFL superstar to a drug addict living on the streets.
Wallace, right on top of it, had a tackle that made a tremendous hit on Stallworth.
So far today, and he's made two great defensive plays.
It was Ted Jackson, a photojournalist, who found Jackie and began to tell his story.
Hello.
Ted. It's Katie from the BBC. Lovely to meet you. How are you?
Ted lives about an hour north of New Orleans, across Lake Pontchartrain, and has been kind enough to tell me Jackie's story whilst doing all the driving. The day Ted first encountered Jackie was just like any other for him. It started with his editor asking him to head down to a homeless encampment and find a story.
I headed down there and I had to walk about a quarter mile or so into this kind of a jungle area under the bridge, but there was no one there. Things were just really messed up and nasty. And about 75 feet towards my car, I almost stumbled over this human being sleeping on this makeshift bed, and it startled me. He was covered in a plastic sheet. His shoes were tidy, socks tucked in. His clothes were folded on top of a 5-gallon bucket. He even had a newspaper. He was fast asleep. I climbed up on the bridge up over him and shot a picture straight down of him sleeping. And then I came and woke him up. He's wiping the sleep out of his eyes, and he explained that kids were coming down the interstate and they had their guns and they were shooting into the camp for fun, and that they had dispersed. He said, me, I'm kind of tucked away here. Nobody can see me. I'm hidden. Then he said, why do you want to know? I said, well, I worked with the Times-Picayune and we were going to do a story on this camp on homelessness. And that's what he said, now the famous words. You ought to do a story about me. I think I kind of chuckled. I said, why would I want to do that? And he said, because I've played in 3 Super Bowls. And I didn't believe him. I asked him who he was. He said, Jackie Wallace. It meant nothing to me. And I didn't grow up in New Orleans. I didn't know he was a legend here.
When you went back to the offices, yes. He said, guys, like, anyone heard of this?
Yes, exactly. I jumped in the car and I drove back pretty fast, probably. I said, is this true? Could this possibly be true? And I the 3 flights of stairs up to the newsroom and went straight to the sports departments. And I said, have you ever heard of a guy named Jackie Wallace? And every head popped up. What? Jackie? Several reporters gathered around the desk and started telling me about Jackie Wallace, who he was. And I remember Jimmy Smith asking me, you think he's still there? Probably. He said, oh, I hope so. I hope so. And so we jumped in the car and ran back. And the cool thing is that Jimmy had just finished a 3-day series on sports heroes. Where are they today? And the shocking thing is that newspaper that was folded by Jackie's elbow in the photo is the 3rd installment. And the subject of that story was Joe Ehrman, a friend of Jackie's when he played for the Colts. Jackie was high on crack, bought a newspaper that day, like he did every day, read about his old friend Joe, how he had left football and become a preacher, folded it up, laid down, went to sleep. And he wakes up with a reporter photographer standing over him. Why wouldn't he say, you ought to do a story about me?
Ted's story, Hometown Hero, Found Under a Bridge, hit the papers that week. It sent shockwaves through New Orleans. As we drive down the highway alongside the Mississippi River, its rippling surface makes me think of those turbulent turns that life can take. As Ted explained, Jackie's highs were higher than most, and his lows took him lower and lower.
Getting cut from the team was hard on him. He had always been a straight arrow, but when he was cut from the team, he went into a depression because he still felt like he should be able to play on a high level. He had just broken the NFL punt return record, like the year before. He started drinking really heavy at that point. Some years later, his mother died of lung cancer. That sent him into a tailspin. And the night of her funeral, he went to a cousin's house and demanded crack. That's where it happened. He never recovered from that night. And within a couple years, he was under the bridge.
But this isn't just a story about the savagery of addiction. It's also about the difference we can make in other people's lives. Ted's story was the catalyst for Jackie to get some help. And a few months later, Jackie made a surprise visit.
There's a big plate glass window right over my desk. And I hear this. And I looked up and it was Jackie. And he is standing there, 6'2", big gap tooth grin, in a 3-piece suit. And his arms were stretched out wide. And he said, "Do you believe in miracles?" Then I jumped up, I ran out, and we did the bear hug. And we were screaming, and the newsroom was like, what? But he had charmed his way. This is Jackie. He had charmed his way past all of our security. And he was there to invite me to his wedding. He had met a woman in Baltimore, and they were getting married. They had bought a house, and ordered us, me and the reporter, to come to the wedding. And so that's when it became something very, very special to me, because we became friends at that point. And he called me every year on Thanksgiving morning and wished me a happy Thanksgiving and said, you know, this is what makes the holiday real. And so every Thanksgiving morning from then on, he would call me in the morning. And we kind of became friends at that point. But that went on for 12 years. And then the phone call didn't come. And I thought, yeah, well, you know, I understand. You know, it's gotten old. After he didn't call the next year, I started wondering. Eventually, I became concerned. And so I called his wife down, ex-wife, explained that he had fallen off the wagon. It was now missing, and nobody knew where he was. So he had been sober for 12 years.
Ted Jackson telling us the story of multiple Super Bowl NFL star and son of New Orleans, Jackie Wallace. And we're going to go back to Ted a little later. Here in the French Quarter, the streets are noisy and colourful. They don't need the Super Bowl here to have any excuse to start a party. The architecture is unique to the city, with balconies overlooking narrow streets as the smell of whiskey and shrimp fills the air. The soundtrack can only be jazz, humming through the doorways of bars, trumpets pummeling round street corners, the saxophone lingering on the breeze. You might not think there's much of a link between jazz and the NFL, in which case our next guest is about to change your view. For 9 years, Darren Waller roamed the football field. The tight end played for the Ravens, the Raiders, and last year, in his final year before retiring, the Giants. Quite appropriate, really, as his great-grandfather was a Giant in his own right. The iconic jazz musician, Fats Waller. Now Darren is attempting to follow in the family tradition.
I didn't know about the impact that he had until I had a jazz history class my senior year of college. I think it was like a summer class, summer elective. And the instructor met me at the door. "Hello, like, it's an honor to meet you. You need to pay attention in here. This is your family lineage, your family history. This is extremely important." And I was like, "Huh."
Most surreal experience, sitting in a classroom learning about your own family and not even realizing the impact that that has had, not only on people you might know or those kind of close to you, but a huge international impact as well.
Yeah, random people were right up to me now, because, like, you know, being football, people want to autograph or have get their jersey signed, but there's people that have ran up on me with sheet music, old records, talking about, "Wow, you're Fats Waller's great grandson," and I'm just like, that's even almost cooler than the football stuff. And that kind of sparked me. Like, I feel like a few months after that was when I started my own musical journey, just kind of being inspired by him and being like, wow, he was just, you know, kind of made his own lane and was a pioneer of his own style. And if you listen back to it, a lot of people may be like, what is that? First time I heard it, I was just like, I don't even know what to make of this, because I was at a time in my life where I don't know how open I was to different styles and genres of music. And I feel like as I've grown and become more open-minded, I have more of a taste for it, and I have more of appreciation for just how unique it is. It was an art to him and inspired a groups of people. And I had no idea before that. I kind of saw pictures of him around the house and it all started to click after that. I was like, you know what? It's time for me to have my own journey. Nobody else in my family really keeps this legacy going. So maybe I can in my own way. And that inspired me to start.
Do you feel like it's influenced your music in any way?
I feel like it's influenced my approach to it. I don't need to be like everybody else and the trends that everybody else may be following, or things they may be trying to do to be successful in music. I just need to be myself, because I don't think he was trying to be anybody else but himself, and him being fully authentic was what made him unique.
Time runs out on this hourglass. I hope I find a way to treat moments like it's my last. Except all of the things that I try to change about my past, and finally stop putting on all these masks. Know it get hard to grasp, but God is gonna lead you down better paths.
So I feel like with me, it's like, make the music that I want to create, continue to grow and challenge myself with the types of songs that I want to make, and that's how I want to be like him.
You can't see the way, but this too shall pass. Yeah.
Go with me on this. I'm interested to see what you think. So I felt there's really like positive messaging in there as well. You know, songs with titles like This Too Shall Pass, you know, there is that sense of hope and belonging and being there for others. And it was making me think of the origins of jazz music, going back to Fats Waller, your great-grandfather, which is all about joy wrapped up in sorrow at the same time. And I thought in some ways it's almost like a full circle moment for you that, yes, your style is different, but there's perhaps influences being drawn on there.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah, the whole full scale of emotions in the human experience. I feel like, you know, if anybody that's around me on a daily basis, we can go from giggling like schoolgirls 1 minute to a deep, vulnerable conversation the next. And I feel like in the humor and the vulnerability is life, you know, like there's pain that we can't avoid, tough times, tough seasons, but there are also great times of joy, and that's just life. So to have them weave together in my music is, it's crazy that you were able to draw that tie. I can see it now too, that you brought it up. It's pretty cool to think about.
For you personally, Darren, with the Super Bowl returning once again to New Orleans, does it feel a little bit like it's a marrying up of so many different parts of your story? Because it is football, and it's the pinnacle of the NFL, the Super Bowl, coming to the birthplace of jazz music, which as you've got older, I think you've appreciated more and more how important that is to your family and to your heritage. So it seems like a perfect place for these two to collide together.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful story. I love how you blend all these things together. It's my football journey, and, you know, still trying to cultivate a relationship with that part of my life, because there's a part of me that was like wanted to get out and wanted to be done, and the stress and the pressure and all that I was trying to make it into was just like, I don't want to deal with it, but I have to love and appreciate and still hold on to that part of a journey, because it's made me and molded a lot of good things in me as well. So as music, yeah, it's two big parts of me that are still present. It's cool.
And maybe we could celebrate that with a Waller collab. Maybe one day we'll see you sampling Fats Waller in your work. Would that ever happen?
I'm not against that. I think one day it'll be possible, you know. I don't know if I can do anything that he's doing on the piano. Like, I'm taking piano lessons, trying to get better and learning a lot of things, But yeah, I feel like some samples of him one day would be epic. I think that has to happen.
Well, you heard it here first. So obviously you'll give us the exclusive play when it happens, right?
Totally.
Darren Waller filled with excitement for life after football. It's something that so many athletes struggle with. A little earlier, we heard from Ted Jackson. He's a photojournalist who literally stumbled across former Super Bowl player Jackie Wallace, who was living on the streets. His fall from fame had been dramatic. Having got his life back on track, though, with Ted's help, Jackie had seemingly fallen off the wagon again. But it didn't stop Ted from continuing to look for his friend.
I thought I'd find his name in an opiate. I really did. If he wasn't dead, I thought he would be in jail. The door opened and this head leaned out. That's Jackie. Haven't seen him in, what, 30 years now. I said, but that's Jackie. I recognize him. And I said, are you Jackie Wallace? And he said, who wants to know?
It didn't recognize you either.
And I said, when I tell you who I am, you are going to smile. And I said, I'm Ted Jackson. And he broke into this big grin. He attacked me with a bear hug, another bear hug. And I'm a small guy. And he was so excited. He was living in a kind of a recovery house. It was a halfway house, but he had graduated the program and now he was just paying rent there with a roommate. And he had a hobble to his walk and explained he had had a hip replacement for his NFL hips. We just had a great time. I said, but Jackie, I'm on my way to an assignment.
Can you believe it?
I gotta go. I can't believe this. I shot a selfie.
Thanks.
I have a picture that I sent to my editor, so I said, look who I found.
We've arrived at our destination. We've driven for hours away from New Orleans. The carnival of Bourbon Street's been replaced with quiet and calm. We're at a nursing home to meet not only a great football player, but to see a friendship even more dazzling than the Lombardi Trophy.
Hey! Look at you! Woohoo! You're looking fantastic.
Hi, Jackie. I'm Katie.
How you doing?
It's so nice to meet you.
I'm doing fine right now.
Jackie Wallace is sitting with his feet supported in front of the TV. His bed is made and the curtains still drawn. The breeze block walls are painted white and the floor is that unforgiving and hard-wearing kind you find in hospitals. The corridors are busy with people, and the noises of machines beep throughout the building. Jackie looks up with a huge grin across his face as Ted walks in.
Man, you look good.
And Ted, in turn, has a present for Jackie. It's a framed photo of Jackie and his family. And before we leave, Ted hangs it up alongside all the others on Jackie's wall, opposite his bed, including one of Jackie, in full flow back in his football days.
Up here, I told him about the Christmas tree.
We were told about the tree with all the pictures on it. This is fantastic.
Despite it being February, a miniature Christmas tree sits on the sideboard next to the TV. It's adorned with more pictures from Jackie's past.
Well, that picture was taken when I broke the NFL record for punt return yardage. I really can't feel how that feels now, because it's been almost like 50 years since I had it on, so, you know. But it reminds me of the time when I did run and play. It was something amazing. Yep, I was one of purple people eaters. Yep.
I don't even know what that means. What is a purple people eater?
We had purple outfits, right. and you know, what happened was our defense was so smothering and so dominating that they used to, like, devour people and everything else.
Is there a picture on the tree?
That's one of the purple people right there.
Oh,
that's
fantastic. That's, oh, there's Jackie. Yes, yeah. I see.
The picture that's on the Christmas tree, too, that Ted brought to me, with all the impact people in my life. All right, because there's my sisters and brothers, a couple of people that I really cherished in there. Picture my mom and dad at the top of the tree.
Here's a picture of you that's taken from a video game. That's you running in a video game.
That's pretty cool.
I never got a chance to play the video game.
And that's the thing. As we chat away about football and his career, it's easy to forget why we are here. We're here to find out about Jackie's greatest victory, not on the field of play, but the one against addiction that nearly cost him everything. And it started when football abandoned him.
Saints told me I wasn't good enough to play for them. And I felt kind of let down behind that, because I always did want to play for my home team. But I felt let down. I felt dejected by the Saints. And really, even till today, I really don't root for the Saints, Steve, as a result of that. I hold a bad, bad grudge against the Saints.
You've held that pretty personally.
Yeah, you know, I really did want to play for the Saints.
So was it after that, Jackie, that you felt as though life was beginning to spiral a bit for you? You know, where did the drugs come into it?
Once you started, you can never stop it. It's like taking that first drink. You take that first drink, and once you take a couple of them, you lose the sense of where you are, who you are. You just keep going. That addiction was real, real bad, real, real bad, and that was the lowest part of my life, is going to jail, and going into the jail cell, and the guy said, "Oh yeah, you on television, you Jackie Wallace," and that's the thing that got me with that. I felt so downgraded because I went to jail and I was around all these people that knew me. That knew I had a better life than what I was spending right then and there.
So was it a sense of shame that you'd gone from the football, from being a star to where you were there?
Right. Not only from the football, but from a regular member of society to an outcast of society. And that's the thing that hurt me more than anything else. That even when I got out of jail, I still felt a little sense of betrayal to myself and to the people around me.
What did it do to your relationship with your family through that period of time?
Well, my family always did love me and still do love me. I know my father, he shook his head at it when he found out that I was underneath that bridge. They just couldn't understand how I could go from being on top of the world to underneath the world. Once the article came out, there was no more hiding, no more secrets. Once it hit the front page, people that truly loved me and cared about me, it came to find out about me. I even had old girlfriends wanting me to live with them. And I said, no, thank you. I'm not going to mess up your life like that. So, you know, I get a sense of God's power to show that no matter how bad you get, you can always come out on top. You can always come out doing the best thing for everybody going. It gives some people a chance of hope, a chance of vindication, a sense of no matter how far down in the gutter you get, you can always lift yourself up.
The key thing about this story is the relationship between the two of you. So I wanted to ask you, Jackie, what does Ted mean to you?
Ted been a real good friend and buddy, and even when I done lied to him, even when I done called myself misusing him. You remember that time when I was staying over on staying uptown and you came over and I just point blank lied to him. Then I realized that wasn't supposed to do that. I was supposed to tell him the truth and be truthful with him the whole time.
They were trying to help you out over there and get you some help, and your family was helping you a little bit too. And I didn't know that the guy you were renting the place from was your dealer now.
Right.
And that was nasty. And
right.
But we got you out of that. You were going down fast there.
Yeah, I was going down real fast then, and didn't really see it until he came around and showed me. And I knew what kind of friend he was. It was something I needed to go through at that time. I'm glad you were there, and I thank you for that, my man.
We continue to chat, with Jackie lighting up every time the Super Bowl is mentioned. He wants to see that historic three-peat for Kansas. What an achievement, he says. But what about for him, as he looks back on what he's achieved in his storied life?
Football was just one of the things I did. All right. But being a human being and being a Christian is what I am.
And then it's time to leave.
Well, thank you, Jackie.
Thank you, Jackie, so much.
Thank you.
Lovely to meet you.
Yeah.
Get you back on
the
bed.
Results in him catching
right.
Two big balls again.
Hey,
right.
There we go, Super Bowl.
All Super Bowl, 24/7.
Back here in the heart of New Orleans, where jazz fills the air, it's almost time to enjoy the game. This crazy, colourful and over-the-top city and sporting spectacle. I didn't know what to expect from my first experience of Super Bowl week, but so many people had told me this is the perfect place for it to be. New Orleans, the city of horror and hope, filled with stories of resilience and redemption. Thanks for listening, and if you'd like to hear more stories, just search Sports Hour wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.